Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, diving beneath the headlines on two big stories this week, starting with Charlie and the MBTA. A new report from the federal government lays out 53 necessary improvements.
Roughly half of the findings, we will need to plan and implement a response over time.
Has a lot of people questioning, how did it get this bad?
I ride transit systems around the country and around the world, and it's a totally different experience.
And how to fix it.
What you need is a permanent, annual, sustainable, stable, new revenue source for the operating budget.
And then there's the question of blame. How much falls on Beacon Hill?
We can't have a legislature that talks about equity, that talks about climate change, and is just leaving the tea to the governor.
Or with that governor, Charlie Baker. He doesn't think so.
Do I get credit for any of the good stuff we do, or just the stuff that doesn't work out quite the way it's supposed to?
WBUR sound from MBTA GM Steve Poftak, Congressman Seth Moulton, former Transportation Secretary Jim Alawesi, and head of Transit Matters Jarrett Johnson. We also had Governor Baker there from GBH. So what happened and what now? Charlie Chipio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute, I am going to ask many questions to you. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. I hope I'll have a few answers.
Well, that is the plan, Charlie. So I'm hoping you stepped up with our segment and review today. I want to start with the basics. We've got this 90-page report laid out, findings and required actions. Just for listeners, four categories. One, managing the impact of operations, maintenance, and capital project requirements on the existing workforce, so staffing. Two, prioritization of safety management information. Three, effectiveness of safety communication, so info on safety and safety issues, how we communicate, and then four, operating conditions and policies, procedures, and trainings, which I read, Charlie, as how this runs. Does that seem like a fair summary to you?
I think that is. I think that pretty much captures it, yes.
Okay, so then here's MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak. This is Wednesday morning, before the release of the report, but he'd seen it, talking about the findings.
Of the 53 findings in the report, we do have approximately a third of the findings where we have at least early stage projects underway or foundational projects underway. But roughly half of the findings, we will need to plan and implement a response over time.
So 26 findings with no current plans, Charlie. When you hear that, what do you think? I'm sorry,
well,
roughly,
you know,
and let me be clear, roughly. 26 is roughly half of 53.
Yeah,
sorry,
sure,
go ahead.
No. I mean, look, what I think is, boy, have I ever heard this before, right? I mean, this has been going on for decades, unfortunately. You know, look, one of the few positives that come from this mess is that it does give us an opportunity to at least get a handle on it for once. We've had these opportunities before and we squandered them. Hopefully that will not be the case this time.
So, in part, this feels like a tale of two budgets, Charlie. And I know for some listeners, as soon as the word budget comes out of my mouth, they're like, yeah, what else can I do right now?
But I used to be one of those.
Right.
But now I'm reformed.
So why? Why is budget so important here and so urgent for the broader public to understand?
Well, basically, I would put it this way, in a way for people to understand. There have been a few of us who have, for about 25 years now, been saying, look, the MBTA has got to prioritize maintaining what it has and making sure that what it has is safe over building new stuff.
I'm going to pause you there. Maintaining what it has is operations. Building new stuff is roughly
capital.
Go ahead.
And those are the two budgets, exactly. And, you know, that is not to say that we can't build new stuff and we shouldn't build new stuff. That's not the point. But I think we have really essentially a moral responsibility to at least pre-pandemic, what was a million riders a day, to make sure that what they use, what they're riding is going to be safe and has a reasonable opportunity and reasonable chance to get them where they need to go in a timely manner. And, you know, I think they over, more than two decades, certainly. And this goes back to the Big Dig and requirements that came out of the Big Dig. You combine that with the just sort of the political reality that building new stuff and cutting ribbons is, you know, is often, you know, kind of like crack, you know, and that it's irresistible. And you find yourself in a position where it's all too easy for a lot of elected officials to essentially say, well, yeah, we can get to that in a couple of years, but so, let's build this nice new thing.
So let's pick the thread up there, Charlie. One of the things we wanted to focus on today, we've had a lot of conversation over the last few weeks and certainly on air this week.
Sure.
About where the fault lies with the, you know, the MBTA internal management, et cetera. Wanted to widen the scope here to the legislature, to the current governor, to what's going to be necessary from the future governor. And on the money side, one of the things the FTA said was too much emphasis on capital, not enough on operations. Jim Aloisi, former transportation secretary, pointed out to me earlier this week, last year the T shifted $500 million from operations to capital. Even though we're facing future, you know, potential shortfalls. But he also really came after this idea that, you know, $200 million here, which the governor is assigning, the $266 million that the legislature set aside for these improvements is not strategy. Here he is.
What you need is a permanent, annual, sustainable, stable, new revenue source for the operating budget. And so all this is all the legislature has done and all the governor is going to do is give us one-shot deals that will expire and thereby kick the can to the next legislature, kick the can to the next governor. What we need is a permanent, annual, stable new revenue source.
Permanent, annual, stable, new, Charlie Chipio of the Pioneer Institute. That sounds like the legislature has to step up, but I feel like for every minute of my life that I have been covering the T, we've heard people say the legislature needs to do more. And is this enough? Are we going to see different allocations and different approaches to budgets in the future?
Well, I think we will. Let me go back a little bit and respond to what Jim said. I think I definitely agree with him that it was an error, certainly, to move that $500 million from operating to capital. Where I disagree with Jim is this idea that, you know, Jim talks about kicking the can down the road. I think that just putting a ton of new money into the MBTA as, you know, statistically the second least efficient transit agency in America. And let me just take a second to let that sink in.
And explain it.
Yeah. Okay. So if you look at, go on and look at all the stuff that the that you know you can get from the National Transportation Database and all this sort of wonky stuff. You know, it has information there about what it costs to do basic things that every transit agency does. Now, the background you need to understand about that is that transit agencies are inefficient. Like, you know, you talk about government is inefficient. Well, transportation agencies, transit agencies in particular, are inefficient, like exponentially more than that. Okay. And yet the MBTA is exponentially more inefficient than 99% of other transit agencies. And whereas Jim says that we are kicking the can down the road if we don't push all this money into it, what I would say is we're kicking the can down the road if we don't get at why the MBTA is so monumentally inefficient.
So we talked with Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton on Wednesday morning, and in this particular part of the conversation, we were talking with him about dismay he had expressed, this is before the FTA report, when he saw what the Orange Line Improvement Plan for these 30 days was when he met with the MBTA on Monday. And here he is.
This would be like closing down I-93 for a month so that you could fill potholes and repaint lane lines. This is basic stuff, and yet they couldn't get it done.
And I feel like, Charlie, that underscores your argument about the efficiency thing. But I'm also struck by the fact that when you read the, you know, the lots of text in the 90-page report, one of the things that comes forward is that the MBTA was responsible for 94% of all injuries that happened in rail-to-rail collisions in the entire U.S. light rail industry between 2017 and 2021. And when, yes, so efficiency, but also when we're responsible for 94% of the injuries in light rail, don't we have to put more money there?
Well, but yes, but how do, the question is not that we have to invest more money in it. The question is, how do we get that money? Okay. And my response to that is, well, we have a bankrupt, few quick things. We have a bankrupt MBTA pension system that provides not only the employees not only contribute less, get much more than state employees, but they also get Social Security, unlike state employment agencies. And because they can retire so early, we have more people collecting than contributing. Okay, so that means that we now, that the amount of money that the T puts into that has quadrupled over a short period of time. It's over $120 million a year. The MBTA cannot, for example, just simply contract out the non-core functions it doesn't do well that every other transit agency does, because we have a state law that doesn't allow that to happen. And by the way, as much as I understand what Seth Moulton had to say, and he's right, when the MBTA did try to do that, where it could have cut its bus maintenance costs in half and improve efficiency, he, along with the rest of the delegation, signed a letter to Governor Baker protesting that.
Because it was privatization.
Exactly.
All right. So, Charlie, I'm going to stop you there because that lays that out well. And I just learned three or four really new things from you there, which I appreciate. I want to look ahead a little bit now.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to play you some sound, and then I'm not going to ask you the question you think I'm going to ask you after I play you that sound. All right. So this is Governor Baker on GBH's other public morning radio show earlier this month talking about the T.
Do I get credit for any of the good stuff we do, or just the stuff that doesn't work out quite the way it's supposed to? Look, I get the fact, as I just said, I have 40,000 executive branch employees, 250 agencies, 15 or 16 independent authorities. That's all part of my purview.
We've had plenty of conversations here on Radio Boston about whether things stick to Charlie Baker or not. What I want to ask you is the second half of that. That's a huge job he's laying out that somebody else is going to be doing starting
That's
in
right.
January. There are three candidates truly vying right now, Maura Healey, Chris Doty, Jeff Deal. Have you heard anything from any of those three candidates that makes you feel that they have their eyes on the MBTA at the level that this moment requires?
No, I haven't. And Tiziana, you've heard me on this before. I am sorry to say, maybe I've been at this too long, but I'm a pessimist when it comes to the T at this point. What I see so far is that, you know, Maura Healey will probably follow the usual playbook and usual Democratic playbook and not address any of the efficiency issues, and that Chris Doty and Deal would, you know, follow the usual Democratic playbook or usual Republican playbook and just kind of starve it. And not really dig in and address any of the issues. So,
well, that's depressing.
It is depressing. But I mean, to me, this is the issue that we have, you know, that I think that there are clear accountability issues at the T that simply need to be addressed. And it's, you know, believe me, I am not a Mensa member. Okay. This is like 101 kind of stuff. This is very basic stuff, but doing it, you can't do it without stepping on some toes. And, you know, again, I go back to the perfect example when the bus maintenance is the poster child for inefficiency at the T. But when they tried to do something about it, they get the letter from every member of the of the delegation saying, oh, no, you can't do that. You know, it's going to step on the union's toes. You know, as long as that's the case, this doesn't get fixed.
Really interesting. So the new thing that you've introduced for me, Charlie, in particular there is I'm thinking, what about the governor? What about Beacon Hill? And you're also saying, what about our congressional delegation? And that's an interesting add. Charlie Chipio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute, sometimes talks tea with us. Charlie, glad that you did so today. Thanks for joining us.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
So two big stories this week where we want to dive beneath the headlines because we're just that bold. And the news just keeps coming in the primary race for the Suffolk County DA. We've got a lot of questions about, so that happened, what's next there too. And we're joined by Susan Tracy, president of local public relations firm, The Strategy Group. Susan, welcome.
Thanks, Tiziana. Nice to be here.
Great to have you. So I've got to do the quick rundown, right? We have a contested race between interim DA Kevin Hayden, Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo. A few weeks ago, the Boston Globe releases a report suggesting that Hayden had failed to prosecute a transit officer after an off-duty altercation. Hayden denies, then later announces a grand jury. Fast forward, then we have the news that breaks from the Boston Globe about two accusations in high school for Ricardo Arroyo of sexual assault. There were investigations, no charges. One of those two victims says, he didn't do it and I'm backing him. Then this week, the other one comes out and says, he did and I'm upset that we're not seeing changes in endorsements. The changes in endorsements then follow. And then yesterday, Arroyo goes, oh, and the Boston City Council explodes like a nuclear bomb. And then yesterday, Arroyo goes to court to get the documents released to him, and a judge determines that redacted they can come out. Did I get all that right?
I think you got it right. That was very impressive. You almost forgot the nuclear bomb, but other than that, it was very good.
Right. So first, looking forward. So that happened. Now what? Right. The documents, if when Arroyo gets them, is it in the public interest for them to be out there, understanding not all will come out and they will be redacted?
Honestly, I don't know that these documents that, you know, we're waiting for are going to matter. You know, the woman is on the record, and that's what the endorsement, those who took their endorsements back, they responded to her. They're responding her saying it was real. If this comes out and somehow, you know, exonerates Ricardo Arroyo, does that mean she lied and everyone should change their position? I just don't see that there's anything that will come from this that honestly is going to change minds. That's my take on it.
And put that take in the context of the fact that we no longer have primary day, right? So primary day is September 6th, but people have been voting. Some cast votes for at least Arroyo before this news came out. So we're in a voting season now. How does that affect all of this?
29,000 people have already voted in Suffolk County. They voted, many of them, without knowing this information. It has. The cadence of campaigns has changed dramatically. We don't gear up to an election day and kind of have that rhythm. It's, you're right, it's over weeks and weeks and weeks. Honestly, this race, I would imagine most people have probably made up their mind which side they're on in this. They probably have. They either believe her and, you know, think that, you know, that he's not being honest and open, or they say he was a young guy. You know, this happens, you know, he doesn't see it the same way she does. That's life. That's not how I'm going to judge him. I'm with him on the issues. So I honestly think, again, I think this report will come out today. I don't know that it's going to change anything. I think decisions have been made, people's minds have been made up, and 30,000 people have already voted in this race. Honestly, what I'm focused on the most is what you said earlier about the city council blowing up.
So talk about that.
Because the key for this city and for healing and for being in a good place is going to be how we respond to whomever the winner is. And if we are so polarized right now on this race and on these candidates, and you're right, that city council the other day was like something, I worked in city government. I have been, you know, part of and around politics for my entire professional life. You know, that brought me back to school busing days.
Mm, 1974.
That was, it did. It brought me back to those horrors.
No. So yeah. Let me just give the listeners some sound to join with you in reacting to this. All right. So I'm going to give two pieces of sound here. First is Tanya Fernandez Anderson, who is the first African immigrant elected to be a Boston City Council member. Do we have that
People
sound?
People calling me and telling me, don't say anything. Stay in your lane. Be quiet. Sit down. You will lose your seat. They won't vote for you. Don't fight. What the f*** do I have to do in this f***ing council in order to get respect as a Black woman?
And that's in the context of questions about supporting Arroyo. Then you get, and I don't mean then sequentially. Here's the other piece of sound I have for you. Frank Baker, a white Boston city councilor, also talking about Arroyo, who says this.
If a predator continues to roam, the killing field only becomes larger. Thank you, Mr. President.
The chair.
I had not thought about busing. Susan, I had not thought about 74 until you said it that way. But that level of separation by race, anger, and these are officials. These are elected officials.
Absolutely.
Elected for the city of Boston.
I look at the DA's race and I say, people are going to make their decisions. The facts are out there. They're going to decide. This is in the voters' hands. 30,000 of them have already voted. They're going to make a judgment about what the character is, what the policies are, how they're going to run the office of the person that they're going to elect for DA. They have a lot of information about both of these candidates, and I believe they will make their choice based upon where their heart and their head is on this. But how, as a city, we respond after this election, no matter which one of them gets elected, is going to be really important. Because if the anger that we are seeing in the city council and the anger that we are seeing on the streets in these campaigns continues post-Tuesday, that's a very bad thing for our city. And so to me, we need leadership and healing after Tuesday. People will vote. They'll decide what's best for Suffolk County and what the kind and quality and caliber of leader they want to be the district attorney. But we as a city need to figure out how to move from that.
All right. So then there's this additional challenge that could be introduced in either case, Susan. So let me play out a couple of scenarios for you. So Suffolk County, interim Suffolk County DA Kevin Hayden becomes Suffolk County DA Kevin Hayden. Arroyo has accused Hayden of being the one who is responsible for the leak of the documents. The Boston police have said they did an internal investigation, which they believe means it didn't come from them. That could be criminal, as I understand it. So all of these are ifs. The Hayden fans are going to go crazy that these words are coming out of my mouth. But There is at least a possibility. There's an accusation that we might later find that out. On the other side, one of the things that Hayden has emphasized, if a Ricardo Arroyo becomes DA, is Arroyo said on his documents,
application.
Right, that he had never been investigated for a crime, and that the Globe has reported that the Boston police reports say that he knew that he was investigated for a crime. If more of that came out, now you have a divided city, a person who is coming in under tough circumstances with low trust, and then something could, and I'm not saying any of this we know. I want to be super clear, but we are scenario gaming here.
Mm-hmm.
What then happens, and what do we have to be ready for, given that there's mess going in no matter who gets elected?
Look, it is in the interest of our city and, all of the people in it and the divisions that we've seen in the past in our city to figure out how to heal. And I know that that is going to be hard. The emotion on both sides of this is really intense, and the anger and the frustration. Honestly, we need, I don't know where it is or how it is, but we need leadership that can bring people together after this. And you're right, those are scenarios, those are ifs. If they play out in either case, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know how that will play. But I do know that what we saw in the council and the level of anger and frustration and hate, really, that we have seen has to end. We need leadership in our city. We need leadership from other elected officials, and we need to come together. So I think it is extremely, to me, that's my big focus on this race. The facts are out there. The voters know. They have two candidates that they can choose from. They're flawed, just like every person and candidate is. They have to decide which flaws they find more acceptable, in which caliber and quality of person is the kind of person they want to sit in a district attorney's office.
We're diving beneath the headlines with former Massachusetts Representative Susan Tracy. We've been talking about the Suffolk County District Attorney's race. I want to broaden even further now. You know, we were having some conversations as a team thinking about what are all the issues that are arising during this primary season. And one is that all of this is happening on the Democratic side. This is primary season. This is, in many cases, it's the equivalent of the general election because, for example, there are not opponents running on the other side. Not in all cases, but in some. Or you just don't have contested seats. What does this do to the Democratic Party? I feel like the Democratic Party has gleefully watched the Republican Party in Massachusetts implode a little bit over the last few years. Are we seeing something implosive for the Democratic Party in this state?
I don't think this is a statewide issue. I don't think we have seen that in the statewide candidates. You know, there's some back and forth, and there's some, you know, clearly, Mara Healey's uncontested. She's going to win. You know, we have some friction going on in a couple of the lower races. Yeah, the attorney general race. But it's not like this. It's not this level. So to me, this isn't a statewide Democratic issue. This is really a Boston, you know, it's Suffolk County, but Boston in particular, it's a Boston-specific issue. And I think it needs Boston's specific attention. And I really, again, I can't emphasize enough. I hope there are leaders in the city who will be the bridge that says, okay, we got to come together here. I don't see this as a statewide Democratic issue.
So what corners of the city do we look for? Do we look to for that leadership? You were very clear. You don't have names in mind. But can anybody in elected office do that? Do we need our pastors, our nonprofit leaders, our business leaders?
Yes.
Where do...
Yeah, I do. I think people are going to have to come together. They are. It's not healthy to have this kind of division. It's not healthy to have a city council session like that with that kind of anger. You know, we've seen that in school committee races and other parts of the country, right? We've seen those kind of ugly hearings that pop up. And I think we've always felt like, well, I'm glad we were not there. I think we have to try to nip this and not be there in our city.
So last question for you. You compared it early in our conversation, the bad parts, to busing in 1974. Briefly, is there any point you've seen where people did come together like that? The thing you're calling for?
Well, I think the thing that gives you hope, right? You don't want to just like focus on the negative, is when I do look at our city and I look at our elected officials, it's a lot different than the elected representatives I saw when I was growing up.
In terms of diversity and representation and perspective.
Exactly. So I do think there's an opportunity. There's opportunity there. If people want to, they can bring their hearts and their minds to this. I do think we have all the players in the room. It's not like there's anyone, like in the olden days, a lot of people just didn't even have a seat at the table, right? Their voices were never going to be heard. But today, they do have seats at the table. We do have more diverse representation. And I think that gives us opportunity.
All right. Susan Tracy is president of the Strategy Group and a former Massachusetts representative. Susan, I appreciate you coming in today.
Great. Thanks. Have a nice Labor Day weekend.
Hey, I think I will. You too.
Right back at you.
In the winter months, I would wait for darkness to become something I could see through. Little and frightened, I waited, wishing Upham's Corner would fit in my palm.
That's a piece of Under the Red Bridge, written by a teenager, Blessing, who lives in Hyde Park and read there by WBUR's Sydney Bowles. It's part of a new book of compelling works by young people from 826 Boston, a nonprofit focused on literacy. The book is called This Side of the Hill: Poetic Maps of Our Neighborhoods. And it's a project that combines helping young writers find their voices with painting a picture of gentrification where they live. We recently caught up with two of the young poets, Justice and Salem and were using only their first names. Asia Herrera came with them. She's a teaching artist with 826 Boston. And I started by asking Asia, what makes a neighborhood special?
I think it's sometimes hard to define what a neighborhood is. Like on a map, a neighborhood is sometimes pretty like decided. But sometimes, like for example, I live on the border of Jamaica Plain and Roxbury. So what I consider to be my neighborhood is really a combination of the two. And I guess it's just wherever I call home.
Justice, how about you? How do you define a neighborhood and what is your neighborhood?
I would define a neighborhood as just a collection of cultures or communities. And my neighborhood is basically somewhere where I feel safe.
In the book, if I recall correctly, it has you labeled, which is an interesting word, right, as Dorchester. Do you see Dorchester as key in your sense of your neighborhood?
Absolutely.
How about you, Salem? Same question to you. Both, what is a neighborhood and what is your neighborhood?
I think a neighborhood is a collection of people who really, like, help each other and uplift each other. I've lived in my neighborhood for over 10 years now, and I know everybody there pretty well. And it's just like, it feels a lot like a safe community to be in.
And if we did what Asia talked about, which is look at a piece of geography on a map, mm-hmm. what would your neighborhood be labeled?
Dorchester. I live near Savin Hill, kind of in the in-between of Savin Hill and Mattapan. I can easily walk to the Mattapan Library, and then I can also easily walk to the train station on the other side. So, yeah.
And is this ability to walk your whole community, walk your whole neighborhood, Salem, an important part of neighborhood for you?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Justice, what is your favorite thing about your neighborhood?
Most definitely just the people there. In my neighborhood, I don't think this really gets as much credit as it should, but everybody helps everybody. You just see so many different types of people that don't really care about your background or they don't judge you. It's like you can just be there and exist, period.
So we're talking with Justice and Salem, who are youth writers and members of the 826 Boston Youth Literary Advisory Board, and Asia Herrera, who's a teaching artist. I want to now dive into this ambitious topic. So you're going to write a book. Salem and Justice, choosing a poetic map of a neighborhood in order to take on a complex subject like gentrification. A, what made you want to do something that hard? And B, how did you settle on that as the creative work you wanted to dedicate yourselves to?
I think when we were talking about subjects for books, we were all very interested in neighborhoods. And I think just the topic of gentrification came up naturally. I live on a hill, and one half of it is very white. It's very white. There's yoga studios. And then the other half of it is like Brother Supermarket and bodegas. And it's very, like, you can almost cut it in a line how different it is. But we all kind of blend together, I guess. And we all know each other. So, yeah.
Justice, I know that social justice is a subject that's really important to you. When I taught in a graduate school in a social work program, when a student would come to me and say, I want to write on gentrification, I would be like, okay, be careful, because you got to do this subject justice. And that's hard to do. Yet when I sat down with this poetic map from all these young people, you do it justice. And I'm not making a pun on your name, although it is kind of cool, actually, that we're talking about it that way. So, Justice, was it hard work as a collective to explain the complexities and pain and change and importance of such a complex topic, or did it flow like poetry sometimes flows?
It was a mix of it flowing and it also being hard, so I could easily list the things that were going on in my neighborhood. I could say, this is happening, and these people are looking at me like I don't belong here. But also, it was hard because I actually had to come face-to-face with, like, that's the reality of what's happening to my neighborhood that I grew up in. Like, it really sucks.
So, Asia, you're a teaching artist. You've got this YLAB, this Youth Literary Advisory Board. It's a group of young people. They're writers. They decide they're going to create a project, and then they tell you they're going to do a poetic map that takes on gentrification. Were you excited for them? Were you worried for them? Oh, this is going to be hard. Were you curious? What I mean, as a steward of these young people who are going to take this project on, what was your reaction?
I definitely was not worried. I have seen how talented each and every one of them is, and I have also seen how passionate they are about that topic. And so I was just excited to see what they would come up with, like what their poems would be about.
So let's dive into that talent. Asya talks about you weren't worried because you knew how talented the young people were. Justice, I'll turn to you first, and I'm going to ask you to read a little for us, please. This is Dear Boston. It's poetry, but it read to me as a reader like a love letter.
Dear Boston, I miss you. You're not what you once were. This street that was once bustling, ripe with different kinds of culture, food, and people, is now washed out and left out to dry. I remember playing on these sidewalks with my friends, making mud pies and riding our bikes. Now when I look at those areas, I can't recognize them. My friends no longer live there, the food changed, and I no longer hear the loud music in the streets. Where have you gone? Where has your soul, your culture, and your color, where has it gone? You are now a wasteland left to all the people who want to take advantage of you. They've cleared space, forced people to move, and torn apart the community that used to live here. I no longer know my neighbors, and they don't know me. I can no longer hear children giggling, and I can no longer leave my house without feeling as if I'm a stranger.
That's Justice, a youth writer and a member of 826 Boston, reading her poem, Dear Boston. Justice, what was interesting, there's much that's interesting in that. But one piece that stuck out to me is that you refer to post-gentrified neighborhood as a wasteland. And of course, the common and sometimes socioeconomically tinged or racially tinged trope about gentrification is it turns something that is less into something that is more. And you turn that concept completely on its head. Talk about that a little bit.
Once I did my research, once I was old enough to realize, like, this is what's happening in my neighborhood, I didn't see that at all.
You didn't see what at all?
I didn't see the new stuff. I didn't see, like, oh, my neighborhood is so much better now. I saw that there are family businesses that can no longer be there. Like, everybody that I knew can't afford it. Now buildings are being torn apart, and they put up so many apartment buildings that honestly just look out of place. And there are so many empty parking lots. And I really thought when I was younger that this would be something that would change my neighborhood. I would see more of my friends. I would meet new people. But it was really the opposite.
Salem, I'm going to turn to you. I want to get some of your poetry here as well. One of the things that struck me with both of you is the love for your neighborhoods, the love for community. And as you talked both before about why you structured the book and what you were trying to do, it's clear that love is there, but it comes out in your art as well. So Salem, read for us, please, My Neighborhood.
The hot pavement on the bottom of my bare feet, the summer sun, the sound of kids yelling as their dad chases them around with the hose, the feeling of dirt between my fingers as me and my dad plant our garden, the smell of barbecue and people singing to their music until early hours of the morning, the feeling of chalk on our fingers and then the wet summer rain that carries it down the sidewalk, the sound of fireworks being set off down the beach, and then the game that follows called Was It Gunshots or Fireworks? The memorial candles for the kids that were shot down at the park, the fear of walking home at night. This is my neighborhood.
That's youth writer and member of 826 Boston, Salem, reading from their work, My Neighborhood. If I listen, right, if I close my eyes, Salem, and I listen, it's a colorful poem that turns dark and grainy. I see watercolors at the beginning and I see charcoal at the end. I'm assuming that's the experience you want.
Yeah.
But it disturbs me to think that now your neighborhood is charcoal for you.
When I was younger, my neighborhood was very full of life, and it was very fun to be in. And then once everything happened with the pandemic, a lot of people were moving out. A lot of people were coming in, and it was unfortunate to see so many people leave and have so many different faces in the neighborhood. And I think from there on, prices went up. And because prices went up, there were a lot more white people in my neighborhood. And being there for over 10 years, it was unfortunate to see that, like, only when property value was going up was when things started getting fixed. Like, there was a park down my street that was very worn out, very much needed a new renovation, but that didn't happen until people started paying more just to be there. And because people started paying more to be there, the original people before the pandemic got kicked out.
Does that make you mad?
Yeah. It doesn't make me mad as it does make me feel more upset, because all of these very familiar faces are leaving, and every people that I connected with and, like, helped me and my family aren't there anymore.
And the numbers do bear it out. We looked it up. So Zillow says that the median rent in Boston for any kind of unit as of today is $3,044. By the way, up $44 from looking just yesterday, mm-hmm. by the way. And these kinds of changes, Asia, are dramatic. You're the teaching artist guiding these young people as they use their art to tell these stories. You've just heard them both read pieces that they wrote. You've seen the final product. Who do you want to have read it? And what do you want them to take away from it?
I think everyone should read this. Gentrification is real. So everyone in Boston should be reading this and really reflecting and thinking about how we can push for change that allows families to stay in Boston in the neighborhoods that they have lived in their whole lives. I've lived on the same street my whole life. I can guarantee you if my uncle was not our landlord, we would not be still living on that same street. I don't know where we would live, actually. And right now, rent prices are well above many average households, like, income. And so I think that everyone should be listening to the voices of those who live in these neighborhoods and hearing about how it makes them feel, not only that, but also thinking about ways that they can connect with people in their neighborhood and how we can collectively make a change and push for better rent prices, really, and less gentrification of neighborhoods.
Justice, do you want to stay? Do you want to grow up and stay?
100%, but unfortunately, I don't think that's a reality for me.
Where do you think you'll go?
Hopefully somewhere that resembles Boston, somewhere I could at least feel home, but honestly, I don't think I would feel at home anywhere else.
That was Justice and Salem, members of the 826 Boston Youth Literary Advisory Board, and they are authors whose poems are in the new book, This Side of the Hill, Poetic Maps of Our Neighborhoods, which maps gentrification through the eyes of young people. We also heard from Asia Herrera, a teaching artist with 826 Boston and one of the coordinators of the book project.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Weeknd.
And not just any weekend. It is Labor Day weekend, which means at least some folks will get an extra day for festivities. And that means the WBUR's arts engagement producer, Ariel Gray, is here to share a few things people can do this weekend. Ariel, great to have you join us.
I am so happy to be here talking the weekend, finally, after a very long week.
It has been a long week. I was feeling that just now. Yes. I'm really glad we're going to talk about some fun things to do.
Yes, me too.
And do you have a full 3 days? Do you get Monday off?
I do. I am so lucky. Apologies out there to everybody who doesn't. I'm so sorry.
I think most of what you brought us this weekend, though, can be done on Saturday and Sunday.
Yes.
So, awesome.
Yes.
So let's get into it. Tell us what's happening today. You've got one to start us a little early.
Yeah, and this is one of the most unique things I think that's happening this weekend. It's called Art Battle Boston, and it's actually taking place tonight at Hibernian Hall in Roxbury. And it's really interesting. 12 different artists compete against each other, and in 20 minutes, they get to transform a blank canvas into this amazing work of art.
That sounds so stressful, actually.
Yeah, it is stressful. There are actually three rounds, and the audience gets to participate and choose the winner. This is an all-ages event, so if you have a teen or preteen interested in art, this would be something really cool to take them to tonight.
Cool. Tickets $20, is that right?
Yes, tickets are around $20. Sorry, guys, you missed the early bird price of $15, so you have to pay $20.
Dun, dun, dun. But it does sound like it would be worth going to. Okay, so yes. Now we get some music.
Yes, yes, some music. If you love jazz, you're going to want to check out the April Hill Quintet on Saturday at the Mad Monkfish in Boston. If you have been in Boston for a while, you may have heard April before. She's a jazz vocalist, and she has a really smoky, sultry sound that combines jazz, blues, and soul. And actually, here's a clip of her 2015 performance of her song Black Coffee from her YouTube channel.
Oh, the morning. Longing all the night, in between the nicotine night.
Fantastic. And two performances Saturday, is that right?
Yes, there are two sets, one at 7 and the other one at 10. It'll be a good time to maybe bring your romantic partner out and enjoy the night. If you can't make it, the Mad Monkfish also streams the performances on their Facebook page.
I love that voice. All right, now we're going to a speedway for a block party.
Yes, I mean, how can you go through summer without having at least one block party under your belt? This one is the perfect one to attend. It takes place on Sunday from 12 to noon, and there is lots to do for the entire family: live music, food, ice cream, and for all of our beer lovers out there, Notch Brewing will actually be on site. Also, face painting and balloon animals, just a great way to end the summer with the family.
And this one is free, right?
Yes, this one is one of the few events that's free this weekend, so save some money and get out there.
All right, unless you got a little bit of dancing for us.
Yes, some dancing. The Boston Kizomba Festival takes place all weekend. Long.
Tell us what Kizomba is.
Kizomba is actually a genre of music and dance with roots in Angola. And the partners dance incredibly close together. It's very, very intimate dance style. Here's a clip of the 2020 song Kizomba by the band Kizomba de Boa, featuring artists Lil Saint, De Ramos, and some others.
So Kizomba.
So the festival will have lots of workshops for dancers and DJs. There'll be a dance competition and also dance parties that go into the wee hours of the morning. And this is at the Westin in Watertown. And so it's a little bit pricey. Festival passes for the whole weekend start at $185, but you can also buy individual event and day passes for around $70.
Okay, I'm just going to say it's the Westin in Waltham, and that I love that music. That sounds great. So
yes.
WBUR Arts Engagement Producer Ariel Gray, helping us get ready for Labor Day weekend. Thank you so much.
Thanks. You're welcome.